The Jewish Game of Thrones, Part 6. So this week we're going to go through the Kings of Yehuda and talk about all the different stories that happened in the Kings of Yehuda. But before we start, I just wanted to make maybe a few points about a few general points over here when we talk about the Kingdom of Yehuda. The first point is that one of the things that we saw when we talked about the Kingdom of Yisrael was that it happened many times that there was a conspiracy against the ruling king, and they killed him and overthrew him, and then they started a new dynasty. And so that's not something we're going to find over here when we talk about the Kings of Yehuda. The Kings of Yehuda is going to continue in sort of more or less a linear way, going down the descendants from David HaMelech, son, all the way down to almost to the end. It was father, son. There weren't any conspiracies that started new dynasties. But we will find that there were conspiracies that they assassinated the king, but they didn't start a new dynasty as a result. They just had like the king's son take over early. That's one point. The second point is that because of this idea that it was a continuation, it was one set royal family that was ruling the entire time, so it was harder to change things that were instituted in the palace than would otherwise be. Because once it's already in the palace and it became, you know, the tradition became like the minhag, so it was harder to change it. So one of the things we're going to find is that the story of Shlomo Melech marrying foreign women, and that whatever it means that they made him stray after Avodah Zarah, whatever that means, that sets a precedent for the future where we're going to see other kings are going to be influenced or will not be influenced by their wives who are trying to push or promote Avodah Zarah, like idolatry. So that's one of the dynamics we're going to be working with here. Are they going to submit to their wives' idolatrous desires, or are they not going to submit to that? The third point is that when we talk about the Kings of Yehuda, so besides the book of Kings in Tanakh, which talks about the Kings of Yehuda, there's another book in Tanakh which is important. It's called Divrei Yamim. In English, they call it Chronicles. It's the last book of Tanakh. It's not in the Nevi'im. It's in the section known as Ksuvim, in the writings. Chazal tells us that it was written by Ezra HaSofer in the beginning of the Second Temple period. And so when we want to come up with a narrative of what was happening in the Kings of Yehuda, so you can't just rely on Kings. You have to look at Kings and Divrei Yamim, Kings and Chronicles together, in order to get a broader picture of what was happening. It's like there'll be a story that's brought in one book and not in the other, or in the other and not in the one, so you have to put all of them together. The last point I wanted to make was the concept of Shchutei Chutz. When we talked about the Kingdom of Yisrael, so we spoke about how they, starting from Yerovam ben Nevat and going all the way through till the end, they engaged in what I characterized as the deviant worship of Hashem. They worshipped Hashem in a deviant way, more than just an illegal way, but it was a deviant way. Let's say the two idols, the two golden calves of Yerovam ben Nevat, and he had altars where they sacrificed to these two idols of the golden calf. So that's considered a deviant way of worshiping Hashem. According to a lot of the Mefarshim, according to a lot of the commentaries, they were worshiping Hashem, but it was a deviant way of doing so. When we talk about the Kings of Yehuda, so they're also going to end up straying in a certain way, but I wouldn't call it necessarily a deviant form of worshiping Hashem. What they're going to end up doing is what's called Shchutei Chutz, or Bamos. Now, I wouldn't characterize it per se as Avodah Zarah, but it has a lot of the outer trappings, a lot of similarities to Avodah Zarah. Avodah Zarah is something that if a person does it, he gets kares, right, spiritual excommunication. So Shchutei Chutz is also the same thing. It's an iser kares. The idea of Shchutei Chutz is that the Torah tells us that you can only bring korbanos in the central place of worshipping Hashem. There's only one place where you can bring korbanos. And a person who brings a korban, it's a korban to Hashem, and it's brought with all the laws of korbanos, all the laws of sacrifices, but it's brought outside of the Beis HaMikdash, so that's called Shchutei Chutz. And this is an issue we're going to encounter throughout the story of the Kings of Yehuda, where people were involved in what's called Shchutei Chutz, what the Navi calls a bama. A bama literally means a high place, but in terms of this, it means a private altar. People built private altars as a sort of alternative for offering sacrifices in Yerushalayim. In the Beis HaMikdash, they brought their sacrifices on these private altars. So that's going to be a recurring problem over here in the kingdom of Yehuda. So I just wanted to speak a little bit about this issue of bamas, of shchutei chutz, of sacrifices outside the Beis HaMikdash, give a little bit of the background to that before we go into the stories of the kingdoms of the kingdom of Yehuda. So it says in this week's parsha, Devarim Perek Yud Beis, it says in the pasuk, it says it repeats it a lot of times in this week's parsha actually, but it says that you shouldn't bring korbanos when you go into Eretz Yisrael, so and you find the idolatrous elements of the paraphernalia. So instead of vinitatzdem es bezbachaysom, you should break their altars. Vishibartem es matzevaysom, and you should smash their one stone altars. Vashereihem tisrufun
be'esh. And you says to the churches, like if somebody were to destroy them, we can do that by Hashem's command at this point, but it would be trouble with the law, right? The Christians would be upset with us here, right?
Technically, you have to know every sect of Christianity. You can try. You can have an entire discussion about whether it's considered avodah zarah or not. So, anything that you want to talk about, first you have to clearly define what sect are you talking about, and then try to figure out is that considered avodah zarah or not. So, the general rule would be that Catholicism is more inclined towards avodah zarah in certain ways. Protestantism, in certain ways, is less inclined towards avodah zarah, and then there's all kinds of things in between. But I don't want to get into exactly Christianity. Okay, and then you break the one stone altars and you burn their asherahs, and asherah is a type of a ritual tree that they did for avodah zarah. Upsile lehem tegadeun, and their carved images you should cut down. Vivadetem Hashem and Malkom Alhu, and you should erase their name from that place. Lo yisasin kein laHashem lekechem, you shouldn't do so to Hashem. Rather, the place that Hashem has chosen from all the tribes, to place His name there, you should seek out His dwelling, and you should go there. And you should bring there your burnt offerings, and your zvachim are usually shlamim, peace offerings, and your meiser, meaning meiser sheni, and your truma, and your vows, and your what's it called, your vows and your donations, and your bukhar, and you should eat it there, etc. Basically, it's telling you that you should only bring sacrifices over there, in that one place that Hashem has chosen from all of the tribes. There you should bring it, everything that I command you, all these things only be brought over there. And then the pasuk warns you. It says, "Hishamer lecha, you should watch yourself. Penta alo oila yisalcha b'chol makayim asher tirah, lest you bring an oila, a burnt offering, wherever you see. Kiim ba makayim asheiv char Hashem ba'achad shavodecha, rather only in the place that Hashem has chosen from one of the tribes. Sham talo oila yisalcha, there you should bring your oila. V'sham tasa iskal hashenu mitzaveka, and there you should bring everything that I command." So the Torah in Paras Re'eh emphatically says that you can only bring korbanos in the Beis HaMikdash. Now Chazal tell us, one of the expressions used over here is, it says, "Ki lo basem ad ato ela menucha ve'ela nachla." You haven't arrived yet. Moshe Rabbeinu was talking to the Jews in the desert, and saying, you haven't arrived yet, "El ha-menucha ve'ela nachla," to the resting place and to the place of inheritance, "Asher Hashem lekecha neisen lach," that Hashem is giving you. So Chazal tell us that Nachla and Menucha represent two different states of permanence of the dwelling of the Shekhinah that cause a prohibition of making korbanos outside of the central location of worship. And that refers to Menucha, is a reference to the Mishkan at Shiloh, which lasted for 369 years. And Nachala refers to the Beis HaMikdash in Yerushalayim, that once that was built, it was forbidden forever to make sacrifices outside of the Beis HaMikdash. So there were historically times when you were allowed to have a private altar and bring korbanos outside of the Beis HaMikdash. And those times were from the moment that the Jews came into the Holy Land under the leadership of Yehoshua ben Nun, under Joshua. So it's 14 years that the Mishkan was at a place called Gilgal. During those 14 years, you were allowed to have private altars and offer sacrifices there. After that, the Mishkan was erected in Shiloh, and it was a semi-permanent structure, and that was 369 years. At that point, it was forbidden to have private altars. After Shiloh was destroyed, which was the time that Eli HaKoyen died, which is commensurate with Shmuel Navi becoming the leader, so the Mishkan was moved elsewhere, and it was brought to a place called Nov, and then afterwards to Givon, when Nov was destroyed, for a total of 57 years at Nov and Givon. During those 57 years, a person was allowed to bring bring sacrifices on private altars. At the end of Givon was when Shlomo Melech built the first Beis HaMikdash, and from then till the end of history, you're not allowed to bring off sacrifices on private altars. So that's the history of when was Shechut Eichutz allowed and when was Shechut Eichutz not allowed. So we're going to find that a lot of the kings of Yehuda, even the so-called good kings, they allowed for, at least in a passive way, people to transgress the prohibition of Shechut Eichutz. They didn't take care of destroying these bummels, these private altars, and therefore the people, the masses, were offering sacrifices on these private altars. So the question I want to open up with is, what was the rationale for allowing these bummels to continue to exist? We're talking about good kings. We're going to see that they otherwise were sought to spread Torah, to get rid of Avodah Zarah and all these different things. Just the one thing is that they didn't get rid of the bummels. So what were they thinking that they didn't get rid of the bummels?
What is this word?
Bama? Yeah. Bama, I said, it literally means a high place, but colloquially, in terms of this, we're talking about a private altar, as opposed to offering sacrifices at the central place of worship. So what would you say, Chaim? What were they thinking that they didn't get rid of them? Nothing. Okay, I don't know. Okay, fine. So I found two interesting explanations. One is from Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky Zatzal. In Parshas Re'eh, if you look closely at the wording of the prohibition when it talks about it in the sixth parsha, when it talks about worshipping at the central location, so it says, Ki emal ha-mokoyim asher yivchar Hashem aleikeichem mikol shifteichem. This is Dvarim, Perek Yud Beis, Pasuk Hey. Only in the place asher yivchar Hashem aleikeichem, that Hashem, your God, has chosen, mikol shifteichem, from all your tribes. So Yaakov Kamensky writes that perhaps people justified the use of private altars by saying that the whole idea of the central location of worshipping Hashem is only when all the tribes are together. And then there's one spot that's chosen from all the tribes. But if there's two competing kingdoms, the existence of the kingdom of Yisrael, which from the beginning was legitimate because of the prophecy of Achia Shilaini, but it was a legitimate kingdom, right? So it wasn't something that was completely outlawed by the Torah, but you see that the Jewish people were sort of split into two polities, two political entities, and that made it that Yerushalayim was no longer Mikol Shifteichem. The Beis HaMikdash in Yerushalayim was no longer the chosen place from all the tribes. It was only the chosen place from the tribes of Binyamin and Yehuda, which was one kingdom, but there's another kingdom. So it could be that all the ideas of central worship could be suspended because now there's no one central place for all of the Jewish people. Of course, it's not true that because the Mishnah says that once the Beis HaMikdash was built, so that you can't make any private altars. But this is just a way of making a limud zchus of trying to find a justification for what they were doing, so we can have a better understanding of why the good kings didn't get rid of the private altars. That's Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky's idea. The Chassam Sefer says a different approach. The Chassam Sefer says that we could posit that these private altars were built at times when it was permitted to build private altars and use private altars. Yeah? And therefore, because it was used in a legitimate way and it was built in a legitimate way, therefore those sites, they maintain a certain level of kedusha, a certain level of holiness, that just like we say, lo yisasun kein la'Hashem elikeichem, which means you're not allowed to destroy things that have to do with Hashem. This is the source for the prohibition of erasing Hashem's name. So too, you wouldn't be allowed to destroy these sites of private worship, even though now private worship itself is forbidden, but the original sites of private worship from the time that it was permitted, you're not allowed to get rid of, because they maintain a certain level of kedusha. It would be sort of like destroying a mini base of Migdash in a way. Right? So therefore, the kings didn't get rid of it. But the problem is, if you don't get rid of it, people are going to... They did not get rid of it.
Okay.
The problem is that the site itself might maintain a certain level of kedusha because it was used originally in a legitimate way, but now it's problematic to use the private altars. So the problem was that people took these sites, which are preserved because they were holy landmarks, they were preserved and because of that, and people were using it for doing illegal things of offering private sacrifice. So that's the idea of bamas. We'll see. We'll see it'll come up a bunch of times as we go along. Right, so now we're going back to the kings of Yehuda. So we mentioned that after Shlomo HaMelech died, so his son Rehoboam became king. So Rehoboam is king for 17 years. The Navi tells us in Divrei Hayamim that Rehoboam was a good king for the first three years of his kingship. He was a very good king. He followed in the path of David HaMelech, and he was very devoted to Hashem. But then, in his time, people started to stray, and he himself started to stray, and they built these bamas, or they worshipped at bamas, and they had an Asherah. Now, the term Asherah is some sort of ritual tree that was used for worshipping Hashem or idolatry. So, the term Asherah is sort of like a deviant way of worshipping Hashem in some ways, but also the word Asherah refers to a type of goddess that the Canaanites worshipped, who is known as Asherah. So Asherah has a double meaning, and sometimes it's hard to know if we're talking about the ritual object Asherah, which could be maybe theoretically used in the worship of Hashem, or if we're talking about the Canaanite goddess Asherah, the worship of a foreign deity. And then people started doing prostitution, possibly some sort of ritual prostitution. So this is what started growing in the times of Rehoboam. So what happens in the time of Rehoboam is that the king of Egypt, his name is Shishak, Melech Mitzrayim. Shishak comes, and it's interesting, the archaeologists think that they may have identified the name Shishak in some Egyptian inscriptions, maybe. It's not 100% clear, but his name might be there. The Egyptian king Shishak decided he's going to come fight the kingdom of Yehuda, right? As you can understand, that if the kingdom of Yehuda is over here, it's in the south, Yehuda and Binyamin, so Egypt is right here, it's right next to them. So it's just a hopscotch away. So the kingdom of Yehuda, so the king of Egypt decides he's going to go fight against Rehoboam. And also, if we remember, that when Yeravam originally rebelled against Shlomo Melech, he ran away to Egypt, and he found haven under Shishak, the king of Mitzrayim, until he came back and started his own kingdom afterwards. So, you know, Shishak, you see, is definitely an enemy of Rehoboam. So he's coming up against Rehoboam. And the Navi, Shmaya HaNavi, Shmaya Ish HaLikim, the one who said originally to Rehoboam not to fight against Yeravam, so he tells Rehoboam, you know, you're not going to win against this guy Shishak because you're doing these averas, the bamas and the asheras, all the prostitution, you know, you're not going to win. He foretells doom that they're not going to win. And it says in the Pasuk that Rehoboam did tshuva and the masses did tshuva, and because they did tshuva, so when the king of Egypt, Shishak, came, so they didn't completely lose to the king of Shishak. He only plundered the treasures of the royal family of Yerushalayim, but he didn't completely destroy and annihilate the kingdom of Yehuda. So they got saved, but they lost a lot of their treasures. That's what happened in the time of Rehoboam. Rehoboam it says he had a his wife, her name was Ma'acha Bas Avshalom. And Ma'acha Bas Avshalom, we're going to see, was a very, she did some really sick things. And it seems that it was under her influence that Rechavam sort of strayed from the proper path. And it says that Rechavam had a bunch of children, and he decided to make his son Aviah, or Aviam, to be his successor. Even though this guy Aviam wasn't his oldest son, but because Aviam was the son of Ma'acha Bas Avshalom, who was Rechavam's most beloved wife and the one who had the most influence on him, so he decided to make Aviam his successor. And what he did basically was he took his other sons, his older sons, and he like spread them across the country and gave them like high positions, but he didn't let them become like the king after him. So that's Rechavam, and he was king for 17 years. After he died, he was succeeded again by his son Aviam, also known as Aviah. This is an interesting thing. In Sefer Melachim, when it talks about this king, his name is consistently Aviam, with a mem at the end. In Divrei Yamim, in Chronicles, when it refers to this king, his name is always Aviah or Aviyahu. A different name, Aviah or Aviyahu. So the question is, like, what he had two names, like, what happened over here? Why do we, one book refer to him in one name, one book refer to him with a different name? So Malbim says a very interesting idea. If you remember on Thursday, we mentioned that Yerovam ben Nevat, who was the rival king of Rechavam, he was the king of Yisrael. Yerovam ben Nevat, the king of Yisrael, at some point he had a son named Aviah who became very sick, and he wasn't sure if Aviah was going to survive, so he had his wife go speak to the Navi Achiah Shelaini to find out if the kid is going to survive. So Yerovam ben Nevat had a son named Aviah. Now, the Book of Kings focuses both on the kings of Yisrael and the kings of Yehuda. The Book of Chronicles focuses specifically only on the kings of Yehuda, and only a handful of times tangentially mentions the kings of Yisrael. It doesn't really talk about the kings of Yisrael so much. So what the Malbim says is that because the Book of Kings is sort of written from the point of view of Yisrael to some extent, so you can say that the Book of Kings refers to him as Aviam, so you don't confuse him with Aviah, who was the son of Yerovam ben Nevat. So we call the son of Rechavam Aviyam, as if to say Aviah Shalhem. Their Aviah, their meaning the kingdom of Yehuda's Aviah, as opposed to our Aviah. Our king had a son named Aviah. So the word Aviah Shalhem was sort of contracted and became Aviyam, and that's why they called him Aviyam, and that's why the Book of Kings calls him Aviyam. But the Book of Chronicles, which focuses only on the kings of Yehuda, doesn't really talk about the kings of Israel, so it's not written from their point of view in any way, so it brings his real name was Aviyah. That's what the Malbim, that's how he sort of answers this contradiction of whether the king's name was Aviyam or Aviyah. Anyways, he was king for 3 years. And the Navi tells us that throughout those 3 years that he was king, he was constantly warring with Yerovam ben Nevat, his rival king in Yisrael. After Aviah died, and Aviah as well, he followed in the deviant path of Rechavam, and he couldn't get rid of the Bamas, and in his time people were started doing to do Avodah Zarah and Asherahs and all these different things. Even though it said that they did tshuva, but it seemed like that tshuva wasn't really such a lasting institution. So in Aviah's time, people were basically, Aviah is characterized as what we call a bad king. If you want to put it in black and white, he's one of the bad kings of Yehuda. He is succeeded by his son. His son, his name is Asa. That's a cool name, Asa. Asa was king for 41 years, the third longest reigning. What? Yeah, he's the third one. Third king. Asa, number three of kings of Yehuda. Asa ben Aviam. He was king for 41 years. That makes him the third longest reigning king of Yehuda. And he was what we call a good king. Asa was a good king, and he reversed some of the idolatrous policies of his predecessors. He got rid of the prostitution. He got rid of the different idols that people had. And even says that his his grandmother, meaning Rechavim's wife, Macha Bas Avshalom. So his grandmother did this disgusting thing that the Torah says, that the Navi says, that she made a mefletzes for Asherah. So what's a mefletzes? In modern Hebrew, a mefletzes is a monster. But Chazal tell us that a mefletzes in this context is referring to some sort of, a portmanteau of the phrase mafli b'leitzanusa, which means excessive fooling around, which Chazal tell us means that she had some sort of phallic device that she would simulate fornication with every day. So one of the things that Asa did when he was cleaning up the Jewish people was he got rid of this phallic device of Macha Bas Avshalom, and the Targum in Divrei Yomim says that afterwards she did tshuva, she changed her name. So Asa is trying to clean up the kingdom of Yehuda. There's a story in Divrei Yomim that the king of Kush, the king of Ethiopia, came up against Asa to fight Asa. And it says that Asa had this whole long prayer. He prayed to Hashem that he should have Hatzlacha, he should be successful in the war. And indeed, he was successful in the war against the kingdom of Kush. And what happens is that Chazal tell us that Kush, Ethiopia, had previously conquered Egypt and taken the treasures that Egypt, the king of Egypt, Shishak, took from Rechavam. So the king of Ethiopia took it from Shishak. And now when the king of Ethiopia came up against Asa, Asa took those treasures back when he defeated him. So he got the treasures back. And there's a story over there in Sefer Divrei Yomim that a Navi called Azaryahu ben Oded, who is number 20 on the list of the Nevi'im. So Azaryahu ben Oded told him to do tshuva, and he sort of got the people to do tshuva on a larger scale. And indeed, there was a war between, as we mentioned on Thursday, that throughout the days of Asa, of Baasha, who was the king of Yisrael, so Baasha was always fighting Asa. Baasha, the king of Yisrael, was constantly fighting Asa, the corresponding king of Yehuda in his time. And there's a story brought in Sefer Divrei Yomim that at one point, the kingdom of Yehuda and the kingdom of Aram, in Syria, were joined together. They became allies to fight against the kingdom of Yisrael, to fight against Baasha, or to fight against Baasha and his descendants. And so they joined up together, and they actually won. But a Navi called Hanani the Navi, is he on the list? He doesn't appear on the list. Oh, yeah, number 48 on the list. Hanani Hanavi, he comes to Asa and he tells them off. He rebukes him for not having bitachon, for not having a steadfast belief in Hashem, relying on Hashem to help him defeat Yisrael, and rather relying on Aram. So Hashem sort of sends the Navi to tell him off for that. And the Medrash tells us an interesting thing, that when Asa allied himself with the kingdom of Aram, so those treasures that he took from Kush, that Kush had taken from Shishak, that Shishak took from Rechavam, so those very treasures Asa gave to the king of Aram as a present. So that's like one of the things that Asa sort of criticized for, even though on the whole, Asa was a good king. He was getting rid of the Avodah Zarah, and he was helping spread the proper worship of Hashem. In the end, it says that Asa became sick in his feet. He had a certain malady in his feet or his legs. He wasn't able to walk, and then it says it spread to the rest of his body, and then that's how he died in the end. So he had this 41-year reign, which is a fairly long reign, but at the end he died because he had some sort of feet problem. Maybe it was gout. I don't know. But it makes sense in a way. But the Gemara asks, what did Asa do wrong? The Navi could have just told us that he died. You know, he probably died at an old age. So it could just have said that he died after a 41-year reign. Why did the Navi have to tell us specifically that he had this disease with his feet, and that's why it spread, and then that's why he died? Like, what was this? As if to tell us that he was getting punished for something sin, that he did wrong. Yeah, some sin, sort of sin.
Sin that he used his feet with, right?
Right, something to do with feet, right? So the Gemara tells us that the sin was that he conscripted the Torah scholars into his army. He was always fighting. He was fighting against Yisrael, and he was fighting against Kush, all these different people that he was fighting with. So he was a very military leader as a king. And so he was always fighting. And one of the things that he did was he conscripted the Talmidei Chachamim into the army. He forced them to join the army. And because of that, the Gemara says that's why he was punished with defeat. What does that have to do exactly with defeat? Not sure exactly. I don't know. But so that's Asa and his 41-year reign. Asa was succeeded by his son Yehoshaphat. Yehoshaphat also was one of the good kings. Yehoshaphat was one of the good kings. We mentioned Yehoshaphat before. He was also trying to get rid of the different bad things that were happening in Eretz Yisrael, making sure that there wasn't any Avodah Zarah, these type of things. But both Asa and Yehoshaphat, in all of their efforts, they didn't remove the bamas. They still allowed the bamas to remain. These private altars, they didn't get rid of the private altars. One of the things that Yehoshaphat did was that he encouraged the study of Torah. He sent out different Kohanim and Levim to go teach the masses Torah. So Yehoshaphat was more or less, you know, he was a good king. The only issue that we find about Yehoshaphat is that he's criticized for unnecessary entanglement with the kingdom of Israel. Last week on Thursday we mentioned that there was a civil war between two prospective kings of Israel, Tivni and Omri, over who's going to be the king. And in the end he said that the masses favored Omri and then they got rid of Tivni and Omri was the sole king of Israel. So he said, why did they decide to favor Omri? So Chazal tell us, because of the fact that Omri had his family intermarried with the family of the kings of Yehuda. And because of that, Omri was viewed as the more politically savvy, as the more prominent person, and that's why Omri was chosen over his rival Tivni. So Yehoshaphat was one of these, it was during his time that the connections between the kingdom of Yehuda and the kingdom of Yisrael solidified and became stronger. Right? And in his predecessor's reign, you know, Yehuda and Yisrael were still fighting each other. In Yehoshaphat's reign, Yehuda and Yisrael are allies, but they're too close. They're too close to each other. And the problem is that Hashem didn't like it that Yehoshaphat, who was a good king, was becoming too close and too friendly with, let's say, Omri and Ahav, who were very bad kings. Ahav was the first king to introduce the worship of a foreign deity. He brought in the Baal and the Asherah to be worshipped as foreign gods. He brought that into the kingdom of Israel. So Hashem didn't like it that Yehoshaphat had joined too close with the kingdom of Yisrael. And we even find that Yehoshaphat had a son, Yehoram, who married either a daughter or a sister of Ahav. Her name was Asaliyahu. Right? Omri was Ahav's father. Right? So Omri had a daughter or Ahav had a daughter named Asaliyahu, and she married Yehoshaphat's son Yehoram, and we'll speak more about that in a few minutes. But that's one of the things where you see the connection. Could be Yehoshaphat himself was married to someone from Omri's family. Different explanations. Fine. So that's more or less the story of Yehoshaphat. Last week I mentioned this story of the death of Ahav. I sort of said it a little bit wrong, so I just wanted to clarify it. Basically, at that point there was a war where Yisrael and Yehuda were allied together against Aram this time. Yehuda and Yisrael against Aram, and the question was Yehoshaphat and his contemporary of Yisrael, Ahav. Yehoshaphat and Ahav were allied together against the kingdom of Aram. So the question was, Yehoshaphat and Ahav decided they're going to go fight against Aram in a place called Ramoth Gilead, but they didn't know if they were going to be successful or not. So Yehoshaphat asks Ahav, he says, "No, do you have any prophets?" And Ahav says, "Yeah, I have this one prophet who always says bad things for me." Right? Last week I mentioned Eliyahu. No, nothing to do with Eliyahu. I made a mistake over there. Ahav says, "I have this prophet, Michayahu ben Yimla." He's number 16 on the list of prophets. This prophet Michayahu ben Yimla, he always says bad prophecies for me. So Yehoshaphat says, yes, so we specifically want to ask that prophet. because we can assume that he's telling the truth. He's the true prophet. And then they asked him, and he says basically in his prophecy that they'll be successful in the war, but Ahav is going to die. Okay, and then they go to war and Ahav dies, right? And they're successful. But the point that I missed out when I was telling you the story was, like, so why did Ahav go out and do it, right? So the point was that Ahav had his own false prophets, and Ahav's false prophet, I forgot his name, Tzidkiyo ben Kenana, he brought in these, like, two horns, and he said, like, he said, like, these horns symbolically represent the fact that just like a horn gores its enemies, so too you're going to go and gore your enemies. And Ahav took that as a sign that he's going to be completely successful and he won't die. And he believed the false prophet instead of believing Michayahu ben Yimla, and that's why he went out and he ended up getting killed in this place called Ramez Gilad. So that's a war where Yehoshaphat and Ahav were allied together against the king of Aram. There's another story that's brought in Sefer Divrei Yamim in Chronicles where it says that the nation of Ammon and Moab, the two nations of Ammon and Moab, came up against Yehoshaphat. They wanted to fight the kingdom of Yehuda. And it has a whole story over there where Yehoshaphat goes to the Beis HaMikdash and he has this whole long prayer that he says over there in the Beis HaMikdash, and Hashem sends a Navi called Yachziel ben Zerachyahu Halevi. Ben Zechariahu Halevi. Yachziel ben Zechariahu Halevi, number 21 on the list of prophets. And he gives a prophecy to Yehoshaphat that he's going to win this war against Ammon. And that's exactly what happened. They ended up winning this war against Ammon and Moab. Okay. In the end, so that's more or less Yehoshaphat, good king. He had a 25-year reign. And it says in Divrei Yamim that at the end, the implication is that this happened at the end of his life. At the end of his life, he allied with Ahav's son, Ahaziyahu, right? He allied with Ahav's son, whose name was Ahaziyahu. This is the one who he got sick, and he sent a message to Baal Zvuv, and Eliyahu Novi intercepted the message we spoke about on Thursday. So that son of Ahav, Ahaziyahu, so Yehoshaphat allied with him, and they made a joint investment in building ships and sending these ships to a place called Tarshish. Tarshish was a known port in the ancient world, where a lot of it was a major port in the economics and for merchants and everything, and they were going to send ships over there to do business and make money from it. So Yehoshaphat and Ahaziyahu put money together to do that, and a navi named Eliezer ben Doidavahu, who's number 22 on the list of prophets, came to Yehoshaphat and told him that because you're allying yourself with a Russia, you are not going to be successful. And that's exactly what happened. These ships ended up breaking and they weren't successfully able to trade with Tarshish. So that's the end. And that happened at the end of Yehoshaphat's lifetime. Yehoshaphat was king for 25 years. And he was succeeded by his son Yehoram. So now we're up to Yehoram. Now, I mentioned before that Yehoshaphat's son Yehoram. First of all, Rashi in Maseches Harius says that Yehoram, originally, when he first became king, he was somebody who was worthy of being Yehoshaphat's successor. Right? Yehoshaphat was a good king. Asa and Yehoshaphat were good kings, even though they didn't get rid of the Bomas, but they got rid of everything else. They were good kings. So Yehoram, in the beginning, he was a good king also. And he was worthy of being Yehoshaphat's successor. But then afterwards, he sort of went off the derech, he went off the proper path, and then he became corrupted and deviant and whatever. Right? So Yehoram was originally a good king, and then he goes off and says that he killed all of his brothers so that he won't have any competitors. And he introduced the real worship of Avodah Zarah into Malchus Yehuda. And the Navi tells us that he did bad in the eyes of Hashem because he was married to Asaliyahu. Asaliyahu, as I mentioned before, was either a daughter or a sister of Ahav. It's a contradiction in the Pesukim. If she was a daughter or a sister, then the different commentaries have different ways of reconciling the contradiction. This is what my paper in the Jewish Bible Quarterly talks about at great length. So it's one of two options. She was either the daughter or the sister of Ahav. So Yehoram's wife was this lady Asaliyahu, and under her evil influence, he became also an Ovid of Avodah Zarah. And so he's the first of the really bad kings of Yehuda. He was king for 8 years. And at the end of his life, he gets a letter from somebody named Eliyahu. This is the famous Michtav Me Eliyahu, right? If you've heard of Rabbi Dessler, wrote a sefer called Michtav Me Eliyahu. So the name Michtav Me Eliyahu comes from the description of this letter that Yehoram got from Eliyahu Navi. This is at a time when Eliyahu Navi was in hiding. He was already gone. So he gets a letter from Eliyahu Navi that says that because you're doing these bad things and you're following the influence of Asaliyahu and you're doing Avodah Zarah and worshipping in these ways, so you're going to get punished. You are going to have a very bad stomachache. You're going to have this sickness which will make it that your innards are going to come out to your outside. Your innards are going to come out of your body. And it's a slow and painful death. And basically he had this disease for like 2 years or so. I think I said 2 years. And then he died. So that's the ignominious end of Yehoram, who was king for 8 years. Yehoram was succeeded by his son Ahaziah, or Ahaziyahu. It's interesting to note that Yehoshaphat had a son Yehoram, and Yehoram had a son Ahaziah. If we look in the parallel, Ahav had a son named Ahaziah and a son named Yehoram. Right? So Yehoshaphat was like so close to Ahav that they're naming their kids the same names. Ahav had a Yehoram, Ahaziah and a Yehoram, and Yehoshaphat had a son Yehoram and a grandson Ahaziah. It's like they're even naming the same names. That's how close they were. So Ahaziah succeeds his father Yehoram. He's king for 1 year. Chazal tell he's king for 1 year. Yeah, he's king for 1 year. Chazal tell us that he was also king for another year, but that year was while his father was still alive with this innards becoming outwards sickness. Yeah. So we mentioned on Thursday the story of the Yehu. Basically, what happened was that during the reign of Yehoram, the son of Ahav, so now this is confusing over here. We have Ahaziah, the son of Yehoram, and Yehoram, the son of Ahav, were contemporaries. They were both kings at the same time. And this is the time when Yehu ben Nimshi comes, and Yehu ben Nimshi starts this campaign to get rid of the Baal worshippers. So Yehu ben Nimshi goes, and he kills Yehoram, the son of Ahav, and he succeeds him as the king of Israel. And at the same time, he also kills Ahaziah, the son of Yehoram, who was the king of Yehuda. He kills him as well because they were together and they happened to have been vacationing at the same place, actually. That's what it says in the Navi. So Yehu kills him as well. So he kills this guy, he kills Ahaziah as well. So now the question is, who's going to take over the kingdom of Yehuda? Now there's a vacuum in the kingdom of Yehuda. Ahaziah is gone, and the question is, who's going to take over? So now steps in this lady named Asaliyahu, Asaliyah, right? This is Yehoram's, Ahaziah's mother, the wife of Yehoram, the one who had such a bad influence on Yehoram, right? The one who was either a daughter or a sister of Ahav. So now she steps in, and she decides that she's going to take over the kingdom. There was a vacuum of power, a vacuum of authority with the assassination of Ahaziah. There's no king. So now she comes in and she takes all the power for herself. Chazal tells us that through witchcraft and through a series of carefully orchestrated political assassinations and murders, she got rid of all her competitions. She tried to kill out all the family, all the kids, the whole family of Malchus Beis David, and she got rid of her competition, and she consolidated her power as the queen of Yehuda, right? And she did all kinds of sick things. She made holes in the Beis HaMikdash, and she took the kalim from the Beis HaMikdash and used it for the worship of Baal. So she was a real deviant. Oved Avodah Zarah. She killed out a lot of her own family. She, right, after the death of her son, she killed out all the other competitors, and she took over as the queen of Malchus Yehuda, and she was a big sponsor of Baal worship. And we're going to have to find out what happens next. What happens to the kingdom of Malchus Beis David? Who's going to succeed? How are they going to get rid of this Asaliyah lady? Who's going to take over the king? Who's going to be the king after her? How are they going to clean up afterwards? We're going to have to see these questions tomorrow. But that's more or less what we're holding over here. Okay, thank you for coming. Thank you for staying.